Okay, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Nice to see you all here today. This is my final talk in my series on the book I edited, The Light That Shines Through Infinity, Zen and the Energy of Life, by Dainen Katagiri Roshi, founder of the Zen Center. Today I'm talking about Part 5, Peace and Harmony, the concluding part of this book. The essential teaching of this book is that there is a life force energy, commonly called chi, that flows through everything in the universe, including us, and that energy is something we can tap into and use to find joy and meaning in life. This is Katagiri Roshi's wish for us. Today I'm going to say a little about where I think peace and harmony fits into the picture of reality that Katagiri paints in his teaching. I have a few ways of looking at it that resonated with me, so I'm going to just kind of talk about them and then end up with Katagiri's poem, Peaceful Life. So to start off, here's the Katagiri quote that I chose for today's printed program. We study and practice Buddhist teachings in order to go deep into our own life. There you discover your original place, the place where all beings live together in peace before we exist as individual beings. From that place, you can join the flow of life, living in harmony with all beings and walking together hand in hand. This is the guideline for Buddhist study and practice. So just a little background to set the context for this. Some of it you've heard before. So in Sanskrit, the word for peace is shanti, which means rest, calmness, and tranquility. It's a peace that's always with you. If you practice it, it comes up and you can feel it. You can take refuge there. The Sanskrit word for harmony is avaroda, meaning the smooth, pleasant, and non-contentious functioning together of two or more things without obstruction or hindrance. You can get a feel for what Katagiri means by peace and harmony by thinking of peace as the characteristic of life in its original state of emptiness, where all life exists together as pure energy with no structural forms, no fixed individual beings. We've been calling that original energy Buddha. Harmony is connected with the Buddhist principles of impermanence and interdependent co-origination as the moving energy of Dharma, which creates the material world as one interconnected whole with many component parts. Dharma is like an intermediary. It harmoniously processes Buddha energy in and out of all beings and links the worlds of form and emptiness. When life energy is embodied in all the forms of the material world, it is called Sangha, or all sentient beings. Harmony is often associated with Buddhist sanghas because practicing in a spiritual community is a good way to develop and demonstrate a way of living in harmony with others. I think the phrase peace and harmony, which you will see many, many times throughout Katagiri Roshi's teaching, works kind of like executing a macro in Microsoft Word. You hit one or two keys and a whole mini program gets executed. So it's kind of like Katagiri's shortcut. Saying peace and harmony invokes the big picture of reality without needing to explain it every time. Sometimes, though, he does stop and explain it. And here's an example of him doing that. According to the teaching of impermanence, the whole world is unified in peace, and then life begins to move in harmony. All at once, individual beings arise and form the human world according to the causes and conditions functioning in each moment. Then, even though you exist as one human being, your one life contains all beings. This unified life is your true self. I really love Katagiri's use of peace and harmony to represent the energy of life. It has a warmth of feeling to me that seems to be missing from most philosophical explanations. It resonates with the way you feel when you go deeper into your own life and experience it directly. You feel relaxed and at ease with a sense of belonging to life and enjoying its rhythmic movement. That rhythmic movement of peace and harmony is our true heart. It's a beating heart that we share with the whole universe. The human heart longs for peace and harmony as a kind of ideal destination, but actually it's already within us. I also enjoy the way that Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, the Indian sage of non-duality, expresses this with his familiar quote. He says, "Wisdom is knowing I am nothing. Love is knowing I am everything. And between the two, my life flows." Sometimes Katagiri's teaching can seem just too philosophical. But the reason he explains so much is that he wants us to understand that this is the way life actually is. We can't avoid it, wish it away, or impose our own ideas on it. We have to know how to live on the basis of being part of a world in which we are key players and where what we do influences the whole system. He's always encouraging us to engage in spiritual practice and directly experience what he's talking about for ourselves so that it becomes something real for us. So that's a little introduction, and the first way of looking at that I want to bring up is problem solving. Human beings face so many problems that it seems impossible to believe that peace and harmony is the foundation of human life. So there's a section in the book where Katagiri talks about how to deal with problems. He describes problems as knots that can be untangled by going below the surface of life. Instead of only using ideas and emotions found on the surface of human affairs, it helps to see the problem in terms of a deeper space where you and a problem coexist in peace and harmony. So you could say some problems are better solved by working from the bottom up than from the top down. I experienced one of my own problems untangling itself like this last summer. As I've mentioned before, one of my tasks in life is to coordinate the care and manage the affairs of a family member, Bob, who lives in a nursing home. Even good places like his have problems, and a chronic issue is the in-house laundry. Not unreasonably, Bob is very particular about the clothes he wears. He's comfortable with only one exact model of pants, shirts, fleece jackets, socks and shoes. And he wears the same exact clothes year-round. Not, you know, I mean, they get washed. Different colors. Some of them are different colors. So, in a way, things are pretty simple. But even though he has lots of clothes, they aren't always in his closet. They're in the laundry or somewhere else. I've made many trips down to the laundry room in the basement looking for things. And I've even complained to management about the situation. So it didn't change. One day, a social worker more or less accosted me, accusing me of irresponsibility because Bob had only 3 pairs of pants and it was not enough. He had nothing to wear. At that point, Bob had, or at least I had provided, over a dozen pairs of pants. So I told her that a dozen should be enough. And the problem was on her end. I don't get angry very often. But in that moment, I was angry. So I had to stop and think about that. Buddhism is good at showing us how our minds work. I could see that I didn't like being blamed. I also resented Bob's very limited clothing choices because it was hard to shop for some of the things he wanted. Like trying to find one particular model of heavy fleece athletic pants in the middle of the summer. But even though it seemed I had done everything right and the laundry room had done everything wrong, there was still a problem. And it really was my problem. So I had to relax my mind, let go of my ego, go deeper into myself and open up to the problem. One day the answer just popped up. All you have to do is buy more pants. In other words, stop getting hindered by judgmental thinking. It turned out that no one was right or wrong. It was just that my understanding of enough was too small. Enough is whatever it takes to keep pants in the closet. Probably right now you're thinking, well, duh, Andrea. That was pretty obvious. But my story isn't about what the practical solution to the problem was. It was about how the situation was an opportunity for me to see some of my patterns of thought, my tendencies to approach things in a self-referential way, and it was a chance to do something different. The feeling of freedom that I got from that simple realization that I had the ability to see a situation for what it was without imposing my own needs and wants has stayed with me since then. It's helped me navigate similar situations without getting stuck in myself like I did that time. For me, that is enjoying peace and harmony in everyday life. So the next thing that came up for me when I thought about peace and harmony is the mudras that we use in Zen practice and how they express peace and harmony. Mudras are the gestures we make with our hands. We have 3 primary ones in Zen. The cosmic mudra we make with our hands when we sit Zazen. Shashu, the form that we make when we walk around the Zendo. And gassho, our greeting gesture. These gestures have symbolic meanings that inspire us and perhaps affect our internal energy flow as well. Mudra is a Sanskrit word composed of mud, M-U-D, meaning joy, and ra, to produce. So mudras produce joy. When we sit in the posture of Zazen, we form the cosmic or a dhyana mudra, which represents the universe. Its shape is a wordless communication with ourselves using our body, our deeper consciousness, and the cosmos. Katagiri said it shows the whole picture of reality. You use your two hands to represent the whole reality of your life right in the middle of the universe. When we form the cosmic mudra, we place our open left hand on top of our open right hand and touch our thumbs together above it, making an empty oval space. The left hand represents wisdom, which is seeing the place where all beings live together in peace and harmony before we exist as individual beings. It symbolizes resting and appreciating the original energy of life in peace and stillness, tranquility, and unified emptiness. The left is the source and supreme happiness of your life. The right hand represents compassion, which is harmony with the energy of life manifested in material form. It symbolizes activity, movement, dynamism, and skillful means. The right side is your creative life, where you accept every aspect of human life and make an effort to live in a positive way. The two thumbs that touch represent the circulation of energy through the meeting point of emptiness and form, wisdom and compassion, or tranquility and dynamism as the unified activity of the whole universe. That is peace and harmony. Touching your thumbs together completes the cosmic circuit within you. Some people say you may actually feel electricity between your thumbs. I've been curious about why we hold our hands with the right hand supporting the left hand. Because when you see most Buddha statues, it's the other way around. Buddha's left hand is under his right hand and supporting it. I think somebody explained it to me once a long time ago, but I've forgotten what it is. So I read up on it, and this is what I found. In Soto Zen, which is what we practice, the cosmic mudra is called Hokai Jōin, meaning duality, beyond duality mudra, or hands in perfect balance with the universe. Placing the left hand under the right hand, like in the statues, is called kichizoza, sitting in verification. Sitting in verification. When the hands are like that, statues are communicating the truth that wisdom in the left hand, as the realization of emptiness, provides the basis or foundation for compassion, which can't flourish without wisdom. Placing the right hand under the left, which is what we do, is called gomaza, sitting in practice. Sitting in practice. When we hold our hands like this, we hold wisdom inside the empty space, with compassion supporting it and protecting it from the outside. I still don't really understand this difference exactly. But what we do feels to me like the practice of a bodhisattva whose right hand is always ready to engage in beneficial action. The other one maybe is the practice of a Buddha who's just sitting serenely in wisdom. But if you have other ideas, maybe we could talk about that later. So the form of shashu, which we use when we stand up from zazen and perhaps get ready to walk in kinhin, if we're going to do that, and while we're walking in kinhin, we use this mudra. You form a fist with your left hand, which signifies hiding your wisdom. It's kind of a modesty, protecting your wisdom. And you cover your wisdom with your right hand as a gesture of protection. Standing and walking with shashu demonstrates that behind the dynamic right-hand aspect of your everyday life, there is the peaceful and tranquil aspect that you can always depend on. The third one is gassho, the most familiar worldwide. It's a universal gesture of greeting, respect, gratitude, and appreciation. And it's done in front of your heart. Well, in Soto Zen, it's a little bit higher because our fingers are supposed to be at our nose. And I think it's because of the robes that they wear in Japan. Technically, the sleeves, you know, these big sleeves, and they want them to hang down. But when you do gassho and bow to someone or something, your two hands integrate your whole life of wisdom and compassion, impermanence and interdependence, and offer it to something or someone from your heart. At that time, you honor the non-duality of self and other, recognizing that their life is interconnected with your life. There is just the one life of Buddha that two beings are sharing in peace and harmony. Knowing this is why we practice, to know deep in our own being just how interconnected with others we really are, and to follow a way of life that emerges from that realization. Another way I thought about peace and harmony is as the meaning of the word right. When I started this series of talks, I commented that Katagiri's description of Buddha's teaching seems so different from what we usually think of. Katagiri said, I'm going to read it again, although I've said it before. Shakyamuni Buddha taught that a magnificent event is unfolding in every aspect of everyday life. Vivid, living energy is constantly at work, creating and supporting your life. It is just like a fire that is eternal and boundless. Whoever you are, your life is very precious, because the original energy of life is working in your life. When he says that this is what Buddha taught, it seems unrelated to the Four Noble Truths, which begin with a kind of dismal observation that human life is characterized by suffering. But I don't think that Katagiri's description of Buddha's teaching really is different from the Four Noble Truths. It's a way of making their deeper dimension more visible. In the teaching of Buddha's Fourth Noble Truth, there is a path of action that relieves suffering. We often find the word right as a translation of the Pali word sama. It's used to describe the eight practices of Buddha's noble path for realizing freedom from suffering: right speech, right understanding, right action, and so on. It's a confusing use of the word right, because our first thought is to see it as an intellectual, judgmental, or moralistic sense, as something opposed to wrong. But that isn't what's meant by right. A better translation would be complete, perfect or whole. It's whole practice because there is an awareness of the relative and absolute at the same time. This is home base for Zen. It's the key realization that gives us the basis for living up to the great capacity that we already have as human beings. Katagiri explains it this way. Right means the harmony of the phenomenal world and the source of existence. This is harmony. Between the source of existence and also the phenomenal world, there is no separation. They work together dynamically without creating a gap. That is called harmony. And then, in Buddhist terms, this harmony is represented as right. This is the same meaning of harmony that you'll see in the translated title of the Sandokai, Shitu's famous 8th century poem that's often chanted in Zen temples. Its title is sometimes translated the harmony of difference and sameness, or the harmony of difference and equality. Sometimes it's called the merging of difference and sameness, or the identity of the relative and absolute. They all convey the same meaning. So in Buddhism, right is the merging of form and formlessness. It's about maintaining a connection with our deep self while we do something as our separate self. The 8 practices of Buddha's path become right when what we are doing as separate individuals merges with awareness that we are interconnected with everything and there is no individual self. Then the vivid living energy that we experience serves as an antidote to suffering because there is no separation. For that, we have to actively do something because it's only by doing something we create an opportunity to align our moving energy with the moving energy of the universe. That is what we call becoming the Buddha way. It's experiencing life as a magnificent event. When our conscious minds align with our Buddha nature, loving kindness spontaneously arises. Then we just effortlessly practice compassion as our activity in the human world. Compassionate activity breaks down barriers of separateness between people or things, and that fosters a spirit of harmonious identity with others that relieves their suffering and benefits all beings. Right there, in the spirit of harmonious identity action, is the Bodhisattva way of life. It's a way of life based on absorbing Buddha's and Katagiri's teachings into our bodies, hearts, and minds, and finding what it means to be fully alive, and then sharing our lives with others. Being fully alive gives us confidence in our ability to live in a positive, useful, and responsible way that respects and supports life here and now with activity that we realize will also influence the whole interconnected flow of creative life energy. We are always writing history and creating the future for all beings by the way we live right now. So I'm going to wrap up with Katagiri Roshi's poem. Katagiri Roshi didn't write much poetry, but late in life, while he was at Hokkyoji for the last time, he wrote the poem, Peaceful Life. Shohaku Okamura Roshi found the poem when he was abbot here and was quite taken with it. There's a commentary on it in his book, Living by Vow, where he identifies it as an expression of the Four Noble Truths. So today I'm just going to read it for you with a little key reminder about what the Four Noble Truths are. So here's peaceful life. So the first noble truth is the truth of suffering. Being told that it is impossible, one believes in despair. Is that so? Being told that it is possible, one believes in excitement. That's right. But whichever is chosen, it does not fit one's heart neatly. The second noble truth, the cause of suffering, can be found. Being asked, what is unfitting? I don't know what it is, but my heart knows somehow. I feel an irresistible desire to know what a mystery human is. The third truth is that there is a way to relieve suffering. As to this mystery, clarifying, knowing how to live, knowing how to walk with people, demonstrating and teaching, this is the Buddha. The fourth truth is commitment to the Eightfold Path of Practice. From my human eyes, I feel it's really impossible to become a Buddha. But this I, regarding what the Buddha does, vows to practice, to aspire, to be resolute, and tells myself, yes, I will. Just practice right here now and achieve continuity endlessly, forever. This is living in vow. Herein is one's peaceful life found. So I'm going to end with that. I would like to thank Tim for giving me a chance to talk about the book as I have been, and all of you for listening to me. This series of talks has really been a wonderful opportunity to me to think about Katagiri Roshi's teaching in a different way and to continue to learn from it. If you read the book, I hope you'll find something in it that will be enjoyable and helpful for you. So, thank you very much.
Thank you for your example of the problem that you faced, because I feel like that is sort of the central problem we all face, that we want people to do what we want them to do. Why do what we want them to do? But we have to understand that we can't control that. We have to find our own way to find peace. Like you found the simple example, just buy more pants.
Yeah.
But that feels so wrong, because people aren't doing what we want them to do.
What they're supposed to be doing.
Exactly. So thank you for that reminder.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Yeah. Was Katagiri Roshi's poem composed in English or Japanese?
Both. Mm-hmm. He wrote an English version and a Japanese version. So when Okamura Roshi talks about it in this book, he talks about both. He reads them. He reads them both, and says a little bit about the use of words in Japanese and English.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Lee.
Hey. In your first talk about the book, you mentioned that you have an editorial mind. So I wanted to direct this question to your editorial mind. Very near the end, you have Katagiri's talk about wholeheartedness as being composed of seriousness and softness. And that's such an interesting pair. It's heart, mind, and Could you say a little more about why you chose to put that so near the end? It seems embodying and also philosophical.
Which one was
it's
about the very last one?
The Tozan's whole heart. That wholeheartedness is very serious, but also soft and flexible. Seriousness and flexibility come together and walk together as one.
Oh, that sounds good. Well, there's the two things. Life is hard and life is a joy. And I don't know if this is exactly it, but I put Katagiri's calligraphy in the front of the book. Strength to live. Joy to be allowed to live. And so the strength is because life is hard. We need to find our resources. We need to go deep and find our strength. But joy is soft. It doesn't take much. It's there waiting for us all the time. We just have to, you know, clear our minds enough to receive it. That's what I have.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
One thing that has been giving me, and I think a lot of us here, a lot of strength, over the past year's political climate, is one thing that I've come back to that Katagiri said and that Dogen said that has been impossibly valuable. Because I think a lot of us in this room weren't born yet, but some of us remember when the Watergate scandal made us feel like, okay, so America is a really collapsible institution, isn't it? And that the feeling over the past year that it's been even more stressful is where Katagiri and then before him Dogen say, you bless the whole world. It may not be noticed by you or others, but it is so. The concept that we as an individual are able to bless the whole world and that we can, in our own way, make our own significance. Mm. That's really hard to wrap your mind around, the idea that you bless the whole world and everybody in this room has that capacity. Mm. But it's been a great source of strength and desire to keep going on for me, the idea of the individual blessing the whole world. It's really hard to understand, and I think was kind of valuable. I have a quote from Dogen up in my kitchen about blessing the whole world. And over this past year, that's been very important to me. And I think every one of us as an individual to at least see that very wise people have put that forward has been very, very valuable.
Thank you. That very, very well spoken. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, sir.
You said that writing this book, you saw, you read the book in a different way. How so?
Speaking about it, you mean speaking about it was...
You said that writing your book, I think you said in the act of writing this book that you saw his writings in a different way. Isn't that what you said?
Today I was talking about speaking, maybe using this, but yes, I'll just answer. I'll give you an answer. When I actually did study with Katagiri Roshi in the 80s, mostly, I'm not sure I really did understand what he was teaching. He was so philosophical about areas that were so unfamiliar to me, and his teaching style was very circuitous and imprecise at times. So my experience was understanding some of it and resonating with some of it, but not intellectually feeling that I could bring it into my own life. But through working as an editor, it became really part of my life. And it became part of the whole picture of my life, because at the time that I was doing it, I had a lot of problems in my life that commingled with the experience of editing his teaching and became a big resource for me. So it became a living thing rather than an intellectual thing for me. Yeah.
Thank you for openly sharing with us your experience of how you were first introduced to the teachings, and then you were writing about it, and then I think what you were saying today is even when you were preparing your speaking about it, you began to think of it in even yet a different way.
Yes.
And I just appreciate you wanting to share that with all of us. And the series has been quite interesting, because even across the series, I've seen things change.
Mm-hmm.
And just a reminder that the teachings, while there maybe were specific words said and written down at some point, that the teaching is really about how each person hears it and understands it, and mm-hmm. the interpretation does change over time. Thank you.
Thank you. Stephanie.
I just liked how you said that we're allowed to live. That's so cool.
And it's a joy.
It is. It just really opens all kinds of angles, and that's great. Thank you for that.
Okay, I think we can go to announcements. Thank you.